Welcome to episode 48 of the Serious About Security podcast for July 16th, 2013, brought to you by the Center for Education and Research in Information Assurance and Security, or SERIAS, at Purdue University. I'm Preston Wiley, and I'm joined again by Keith Watson and Mike Hill. And Keith has the first article this week. So we're going to talk about Android because we kind of love Android and its various vulnerabilities. And this one is going around by the title of Vulnerability with the Android Master Key, and that is probably the worst title known to man because that's not actually the issue at all. The issue lies in the way the verification of files in the application package archives are verified. And normally there's a meta info file which lists all the files in the archive and the checksums associated with each file. So when they're installed, they can be validated to make sure they installed correctly and that they're not malicious. But it doesn't necessarily check very well because you can actually insert additional files into the zip formatted archive file. And the check will verify the signature of the first file in the archive, and if you created a second file with the same name, it would actually install the second file, or at least overwrite the first file that was installed with the second file. So this is a little bit of a bug in the way the unzipping utility works. And what you can do is you can take a perfectly good signed application package archive file and assert additional malicious files in that archive. And it will check that the checksum is correct for the first file, which is the legitimate one, and then override it with the second one, which is the illegitimate file. Unfortunately, it's been going around with this Android master key title on it. There's really not a key involved unless you consider that key like key to exploiting the system or something. I'm not quite sure the name other than a way to grab publicity. So talk a little bit about this one.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't see this as a real major concern. Google's already released a fix for it. I think the biggest issue here is, you know, you'll have to wait to get a firmware update. And depending upon your carrier, where you got your phone, your device, you may not get that update. But I think to stay on the safe side, if you're using the Google Play Store to download your apps, you're probably like 99% safe. Google's aware of this, they fixed it, and you can bet that they're going to be aggressive in monitoring the store. I mean, they know about this vulnerability now. And as they check apps in, I think they're going to be checking for this.
Well, any app they check in is going to get signed first, so that they're going to recreate the package archive, I assume. Or at least verify it, like you said, go back and validate it. So I think if you're using the standard Google Play Store or other trusted stores where that, I don't know who that would be, maybe Amazon. That might be the other one. You know, you're probably okay. It's when you start sideloading stuff or using other application storefronts that you may get into trouble because you don't know how well they verify what's going into their store.
Right. Well, I use an Android. In fact, this is an Android, and I'm not too concerned. So,
your lack of concern is reassuring.
Well, I use the Google Play Store and the Amazon Store. I use both of them. And I also do sideload a few applications from places that don't use the stores to put their applications online. But, you know, I get them from their official area on their site. I don't get them from I don't get them in my email, or I don't download them from untrusted sources. I get them from their site, and I know where to go to get them. And you know, I trust the few that I do that with. I trust the sources enough to install them.
Yeah, I think this one, PR wise, like you said, Keith, the title really is just kind of going for the publicity. I think whatever developer worked on this unzipping software just didn't consider this scenario. And it can be difficult at times to consider all scenarios that may occur. It's a kind of clever, but once it's revealed, it's like, oh yeah, that's not that hard to try. But you know, if your assumption was that you're only going to have one version of each file in that, then you could see where it would have worked as expected. So I don't think it was hard for them to fix. You know, I think it was just an oversight. So, you know, I think you can continue to use your Android devices. But at least if you're using the official stores, if you want to live dangerously, you know, do like Preston. Do like Preston and do some side loading. But, you know, I think, you know, just, you know, teasing aside, if you trust the source, you know, it's all about trust in this business, I think, so.
I think the exploit is quite clever. I mean, yeah. To go into a little bit of detail, an APK, the Android package file is basically a zipped file, and it has a bunch of files within it. And the zip protocol, I guess, allows for multiple files with the same name to be in an archive. Generally, when you use a zip utility, the zip utility will not allow that, just because on the disk you can't have two files with the same name. So in general, it doesn't happen, but the exploit essentially put multiple files with the same name into the archive, and the thing that checks the signatures checks the first file, and when the APK is installed, it installs the last file, because my guess is because it installs the first and then the second one's the same name, it overwrites it. Right. So the exploit essentially just puts a duplicate file with the same name as the previous one in there, that is the malicious file. And the signature check passes, but the malicious file ultimately gets installed.
Yeah, it looks like it used a slightly different path for each version of the duplicate file. I think that's how it was able to get them all in there. Because if it was at the same path, you could only have one in that zip.
Well, most likely they went in and took the existing archive file and then appended to it.
Yeah.
Using a utility to
adjust that.
It appears that the Android system uses the Java unzipping library, which probably is where the bug lies. Which is not surprising, it is Java. But that probably has the issue here, because they're just using what was already in Java, which was the unzip library, to extract these things. So I think that's really where the problem lies. Now, if that's true, then the question becomes, is that a problem in the JDK? So is the Java development kit actually the one where the flaw lies? Or is it just the implementation of it that Google uses? Because they did, if I believe, clean room version, they just use the API and then built their own implementation. I believe that was what the old Oracle lawsuit was about. So it seems like that's a goof they made in the implementation of the unzip zip library.
Well, one thing I would like to comment on as we probably get ready to transition to our next story is that, at least in this case, Blue Box responsibly discloses to Google first before I think they made their PR pitch on how they discovered this flaw. They did disclose it to Google privately and gave them the opportunity to get a fix in place. So, I mean, that's good at least, even though I think they're probably wanting some publicity from it. And there's nothing wrong with that. They sort of earned that, you know, by discovering it. At least they took the responsible path and said, here's what's going on. Here's how we exploited this, and, you know, you guys need to fix this.
they also exploited the choice of naming the problem in a way that ensured they would get some.
Well, you know, I don't know. It does not say in the article whether Google rewarded them for their efforts. So I guess they're trying to, you know, get what they can out of their discovery.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, I will move on to the second article, which is mine. And this is an article, and it was in the New York Times, and it talks about the booming business of zero-day vulnerabilities. And it mentions in the article that the average attack persists for almost a year before it's detected. That's according to Symantec. And obviously they could be a little bit biased because they do make security software. So, you know, a little bit, take some of that with a grain of salt. But the article goes into essentially how 10 years ago hackers would just hand you the knowledge of the vulnerabilities over for a free t-shirt. And now that there's a lot more money in it, there's a lot of avenues they can go for selling these vulnerabilities. They can report them to Google or Microsoft or whoever the vulnerability is with. But there's also these other companies. One of them is called Lupin. I think that's how it's, is that how it's pronounced, Keith?
Lupin.
Which essentially sells these vulnerabilities to governments. And that's their customers, governments. And they charge, Lupin specifically charges an annual $100,000 subscription fee just to look at this catalog of vulnerabilities for governments. And they according to their website, they only sell to governments that are essentially good guys. They only sell to good guy governments, supposedly.
Well, it's debatable who those might be, probably.
Right. Well, they like you have to be on certain, you know, good guy lists. Not on bad guy list.
Not on bad guy list. Yeah. But who defines that list?
So, I thought this was interesting, and this could be potentially where the vulnerabilities that Stuxnet exploited, where those came from, and I wanted to talk about this from kind of an ethical standpoint. The ethics of doing this. I mean, we're all three of us here are CISSPs, and kind of part of the CISSP is we have a code of ethics that we're expected to follow. I mean, the enforcement of that is questionable, and I don't know.
That's a different debate, though.
So yeah. That's a different debate. But I mean, how ethical is this to essentially sell these vulnerabilities to a government who pretty much know what they're going to be using them for? I mean, I don't think there's any question that they're not going to be necessarily using them for good, although that's also debatable, depending on how you think of it.
Yes, there's some question as to how these are used. I did talk to a U.S. defense contractor one time, and he was in the software and security business, and I asked him if his company was involved in buying exploits or developing them, and he said they have a team that actually looks for exploits or vulnerabilities, I should say, and then creates exploits to put in their catalog. They also went out onto the market to these guys, the various little guys, and bought them from them as well. And my understanding, the way he described it, was if they have a large enough catalog, that kind of ensures a government contract with specifically U.S. government in this case to make that catalog available to the government. And so by having a larger catalog than another defense contractor's catalog of exploits, it was more likely that you would get, you know, you'd win the bid for that sort of thing. So they were in the business of collecting a lot of vulnerabilities. I don't know if that's a viable business right now. It probably is, but down the road, I don't know how well that'll work. Because as you pointed out, a lot of these smaller individuals, hackers, whatever you want to use as a term, would give them to the original vendor. The vendor would then make a patch, and then that has now become a new economy. And we're now trading in vulnerabilities. And those that are affected by it are not just other governments, it's individual citizens, it's companies trying to do business. So then, as you point out, there's an ethical concern here. You're not attacking governments, but you have the weapon, if you will, to attack anybody with a device, an account.
Right. Well, so, the idea is that as long as these vulnerabilities are viable for the government to purchase, they can be used to exploit individuals as well. Because soon as individuals are saved, the government probably will not be able to use them as they would like.
Well, in some respects, they're of limited value.
Okay, and we're back. That's our network connection to the network. So Keith can continue where he left off if he remembers what he was talking
I think
about.
I was talking more about having a large number of exploits and vulnerabilities under your arsenal,
kind of like
an arms race in terms of what we had in the past with the Cold War, where it's nuclear weapons.
Yes.
So we kind of maybe learned from the Cold War, although it dragged on much longer than it probably should have. I don't know how quickly we'll learn from this type of weapons.
Well, this is kind of, I mean, when you think of the Cold War, this is more about buying the scientists, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that's all like, part of building your arsenal.
Right.
Well, the problem here that I see is, 10 years ago, there really was no market so much. I mean, you could just disclose. A lot of times, programmers that found flaws or hackers that found flaws would just hand them over for free. And then over time, I think Stuxnet really helped elevate this. It's like there's a big market out there now. And now you've got vendors like Microsoft and Google and Facebook that say, we'll pay. But you could get, you can get up to $150,000 from Microsoft if you discover and give them a solution. You might be able to make 10 times that from a government. And if it's all legal, the same, what do you tell a 21-year-old hacker? I know what I would do now that I have a CISSP, I'm older, I've got a family, I'd say, I want to do the ethical thing. When you're 21, I'm not picking on anyone that's 21 or younger, but when you don't have anything and someone says, well, here's $1 million for this exploit you've written, it's like, oh, well, hey. It's good work if you can get it. Yeah, and as long as that market persists, I think there's going to be a challenge. It's not, like you said, it's not regulated. It's a gray line. Is it legal? Is it not legal? Is it ethical? Is it not ethical?
But one thing to think about, I mean, we're talking about the difference between getting a lot of money and less money.
Yeah.
But Google and Microsoft, they actually market their program.
Right.
Well, these other
right.
kind of don't
right.
market it as well. So I think what maybe they're thinking is we get more people, more monkeys in our room. we'll find them before these other people do.
I think the other side of that argument is they're probably trying to get the brightest monkeys. It's like,
not that I'm calling security researchers monkeys.
Exactly, but they're probably trying to say, we don't know that they're not targeting specific ones. That in that community, as people work their way up, that the governments aren't, that this whatever group this is that's building up this catalog doesn't reach out and say, hey, we saw what you sent to Google, and we would have given you 3 times as much. Next time you uncover something, give me a call. And we can talk.
Sure.
If that's happening,
absolutely.
There's only so many people that can do these things and do it
right.
And that to me is the tug of war is, where do they go? I mean, does Google have to amp it up? Do they have to increase how much they pay? Can they compete with government? I don't know. Governments seem like they have a lot of resources they can use, if they want to actively go after somebody.
But back to my original question, is it ethical? I mean, would you consider this ethical to even sell these to this party who's going to end up selling them to a government?
If you subscribe to the ISE Squared Code of Ethics, as an example, it talks specifically about protecting the community. Although the exact words I don't recall.
Right.
But it's about protecting the greater community. And I see that as worldwide community.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you follow that ethical standard, then no, I don't believe it is. But again, a lot of these companies don't subscribe to that level of ethical standard. Even though they might be U.S. companies, they might have certain laws that they need to abide by. If their buyer is the United States government, then it's whatever the United States government says. It's okay.
Yeah. I was going to say, if you're a U.S. citizen and it's the U.S. government that wants to purchase it, is it ethical?
The fact of the matter is you're still leaving a vulnerability exploitable. I mean,
yeah.
If you sell it to these companies, they will not report it to the vendor, and it will remain unpatched for some criminal potentially to find as well and exploit other users if they find it. And
I think the only way we're going to get a definition of how this was going to work in the future is if, for some reason, a vulnerability is sold to a company, that company sits on that information or sells it to another foreign government, let's say. That foreign government then uses it to attack a company, The company, through the process of legal discovery, determines that, or discovers that the, an exploit was used against them, and it came from this other company inside the United States. And then we'll have a court decision that will help define how this works.
Yeah. Well, one thing I read in the article that I do think is interesting is now that vendors are paying, it said that the one benefit of that is that it is helping in some of these situations. You know, like let's say we're friends, you know, in college, and you discover this vulnerability, and I'm like, hey, man, we should report that to Google, big payout. And I'm like, no, man, I'm going to report it here for a lot more money. They're saying in some of these cases that the friend goes, oh, no, 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 I'm not cool with that. They report it, they get the payout from Google, and it stops it, and it tracks it, you know, ends any opportunity for you to sell it.
And then you lose a friend.
And then you lose a friend as well, yeah. But it is, I mean, that is one benefit. I mean, I think the vendors do need to keep up with this. And if they can up the ante, you know, because I think they are in a battle here. There's a market, and there's a market that'll pay more. And, you know, I think my general opinion, this is just, you know, opinion, I think most people want to do good. And when there's a legal, legitimate way to earn, you'll do it. You know, you think about music before iTunes came along. People were just downloading because they needed the music in that format. When iTunes came along, I was like, I'll give 99 cents for that song. I think people want to do the right thing when it's clear cut. So
I don't know about that.
You don't agree?
I don't know about
you don't,
that.
You don't
think are motivated happens? By money, I think, in this particular economy and you know, whoever pays the highest.
Well, yeah, why do security researchers look for vulnerabilities? I mean, that's the question. And, well, and there's a lot of different reasons.
Yeah.
I mean, some of them are just because it's fun. I mean, for some of them, they enjoy it.
But it's time-consuming. But
it's time-consuming.
You get paid off for that time investment.
Exactly.
How are you going to get that?
And there's always been the credit, though, too, the reputation. I mean, again, vendors up to a few years ago
credit works for a while until the bill comes in the mail.
Right, but security researchers have, most of them have a full-time day job that they're doing.
You wouldn't say that.
You wouldn't say that. So I don't know that they're going
to. If you're asking
that.
Somebody who's sitting in his house, and basement, wherever he's comfortable working, coffee shop, wherever, and doing a job he really likes, and do you think he's working for a corporate monster? Probably not.
Probably not.
Probably not. If he can go make, you know, sell an exploit every few months enough to live lavishly or even just pay the bills. I think he would not actually work for the corporate guy. And given that situation, and I had a little less ethical quandaries about this, I'd probably do that. I'm not very good at that sort of line of work.
Well, I just believe if there's a legitimate, good, respectful way to earn money from these exploits, that will draw a large number of them. It won't draw them all, but I think ethically, when it's clear-cut,
so
like you said.
So how do you define that? Is that
can't
like
do
work
that
for the vendor? For
which well, I think if Google and VooPen, for example, paid the same amount of money,
it'd be easy.
You probably report it to Google.
Would you not?
Well, you probably would. However, VooPen will just raise its rate.
That's true. That's true. They have the government behind them.
That's right.
So
well, the thing is,
because it's worth more to keep it quiet so you can give it to the government than it is to make it public and give it to the vendor.
Well, the problem is defining what the value is worth. It's a commodity. You know, how do you define a commodity? What's it worth? But what's it worth to the
market?
If I found a bug and it took me 10 hours to discover it, and Google said, I'll give you $100,000 for it, I'm thinking that's a big payday. Even if Google gives you
$5,000,
it's a huge payday.
For 10 hours
and,
effort?
And how greedy do we have to be?
And VooPen's charging $100,000 just to look at their catalog, and governments are paying it just to look, just to browse, essentially. All right, and we're back again after another network connection failure. So we're going to wrap it up. Luckily, Keith and Mike didn't start punching each other. You can follow the Serious About Security podcast on Twitter. We have a YouTube, and these are our individual Twitter accounts if you want to follow us. Thanks to Mike Hill and Keith Watson. I'm Preston Wiley. Have a safe and secure day.